morning, everybody. Like you said, my name is David, and today I get the honor and the privilege of ending our series called The Parable of Jesus. This is our final week in the series, and if you've been with us, or even if you're just tuning in for the first time, this is a series where we've been really looking at the parables of Jesus to figure out what does it mean to follow Jesus, and then how do we grow as we follow Jesus. So if you've been following along, we've seen lots of really valuable insights into what it means to follow Jesus. First, it means that as you follow Jesus, you're given a new identity as part of his kingdom. And you have him as the foundation of your life. And we saw that followers of Jesus' lives, they should be marked by things like meekness and forgiveness, and service and repentance and surrender. And really just an all-out participation in what God is doing here on earth and an anticipation of when Christ returns. So that's really what we've been seeing so far. And really to close out the series, we have the perfect parable to end on. We're going to be on the parable of the talents. And I'll get into why it is the perfect parable to end on. But first, I'm going to read it to you. This is going to be in Matthew 25, verses 14 through 30. For it is just like a man going on a journey. He called his own slaves and turned over his possessions to them. To one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, and to another 1, to each according to his own ability. Then he went on a journey. Immediately the man who had received 5 talents went, put them to work, and earned 5 more. In the same way, the man with 2 earned 2 more. But the man who had received 1 talent went off, dug a hole in the ground, and hid his master's money. After a long time, the master of those slaves came and settled accounts with them. The man who had received 5 talents approached, presented 5 more talents, and said, "Master, you gave me 5 talents. Look, I've earned 5 more talents. His master said to him, "Well done, good and faithful slave. You were faithful over a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Share your master's joy." Then the man with 2 talents also approached. He said, "Master, you gave me 2 talents. Look, I've earned 2 more talents. His master said to him, "Well done, good and faithful slave. You were faithful over a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Share your master's joy." Then the man who had received 1 talent also approached and said, "Master, I know you. You're a difficult man, reaping where you haven't sown and gathering where you haven't scattered seed. So I was afraid and went off and hid your talent in the ground. Look, you have what is yours." But his master replied to him, "You evil, lazy slave. If you knew that I reap where I haven't sown and gather where I haven't scattered, then you should have deposited my money with the bankers. And when I returned, I would have received my money back with interest. So take the talent from him and give it to the one who has 10 talents. For to everyone who has, more will be given, and he will have more than enough. But from the one who does not have, even what he has will be taken away from him. And throw this good-for-nothing slave into the outer darkness. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth." This is God's word. So like I said, I think this is the perfect parable to end on. And here's why. So in the past year, my children have become fanatics in the world of Pokemon. Now, I was raised in the 90s and actually was not a fan of Pokemon, but that has changed. I have been well indoctrinated by my children. And we don't just collect the cards, we actually play the game. So what that means is we build battle decks and we battle each other. Now, I could sit up here and explain all the rules to the game to you. For example, your deck has to have 60 cards in it. You can't have more than 4 of any specific card unless it's an energy card. Whoever goes first cannot attack and can't use a supporter card. And you can't evolve a Pokemon the first turn that it's in play. And whoever ends up getting all 6 prize cards, they're the winner of the game. So I could sit up here and I could do that longer. I could tell you more. We could do a whole series about how to play Pokemon as a church. And we would probably close down as a church. That would be the first and the last time that we ever did a series like that because we'd be gone. But what would be so much more effective and engaging and exciting would be if we actually went and played the game. Pokemon is actually kind of interesting because most people we talk to only collect. They don't play the game. And I think that really parallels well with what we can do as Christians so often. We can collect truths about what it means to follow Jesus, but we don't actually do it. So this is the perfect parable for us to end on because we can really hear this parable as a church, as Jesus saying to us, "Okay, you've heard a lot about what it means to follow me. Now it's time to get in the game." And what we have in this parable, we have a master who entrusts large sums of money to 3 different servants. So a talent, some scholars say, is up to worth up to 20 years' salary. So these are huge sums of money, even the guy who only got one. And then he goes away on a long journey, and 2 of his servants prove to be faithful, and 1 proves to be unfaithful with all they've been given. So like a lot of Jesus' parables, this is a study in contrasts. And the contrast really is used by Jesus to show us what we should do with all that we have while we have time to do it. And that contrast is really going to serve as our outline today. We're going to look at, first, the unfaithful servant and the life of careful waste. Then we're going to look at the faithful servant and the life of faithful risk. And then finally, we're going to look at the joy of the master. So to start off, first thing we're going to look at is going to be the unfaithful servant, and we're going to look at the life of careful waste. I'm going to reread for us some of the verses that include him in the story, starting with verse 18. It says, "But the man who had received 1 talent went off, dug a hole in the ground, and hid his master's money." And then skip ahead to verse 24 when the master returns. It says, "Then the man who had received 1 talent also approached and said, 'Master, I know you. You're a difficult man, reaping where you haven't sown and gathering where you haven't scattered seed. So I was afraid and went off and hid your talent. In the ground. Look, you have what is yours.' But the master replied to him, 'You evil, lazy slave. If you knew that I reap where I haven't sown and gather where I haven't scattered, then you should have deposited my money with the bankers. And when I returned, I would have received my money back with interest.'" So the picture of the unfaithful slave or unfaithful servant is really important for us to pay attention to, because it's not the typical image we have come to our mind when we think of someone who would be called evil, or who's someone who's like a bad guy. For example, a few paragraphs earlier in the book of Matthew, we read about another unfaithful servant who, when his master went away, he beat his fellow servants and ate and drank in excess. That's who we typically think of. But this guy didn't do any of that. He actually just kind of seems like he's being careful. I read in the commentaries this week that burying wealth was actually seen as a very wise and secure way to protect your wealth. When I told my wife that this week, she was like, "Well, duh, buried treasure." I was like, I had to read a commentary to figure that out. But it's true. They really did this. It was the most secure way to protect wealth. So you could say he was being prudent. So what we have here is not a story about someone who actively did wrong things or invested in all the wrong things. What we have is a story of someone who didn't invest at all. It's about someone who buried all that they had and missed their one opportunity because they were crippled by fear and enticed by comfort. So in 1976, Apple Computer was founded. Most of us have heard of Apple, and you probably even know the names of the founders. So the 2 Steves, Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak, founded Apple Computer, which is now worth $3 trillion. That's 3 with 12 zeros after it, just to try to imagine how big that number is. But who you may not have heard of is actually the 3rd founder of Apple Computer. There was a 3rd guy. His name was Ron Wayne. Not John Wayne. Different guy. This guy's famous for less good reasons. So if you have heard of Ron Wayne, it's probably because you've heard his tale of woe, because 12 days after Apple Computer was founded, he had his name removed from the contract, and he was reimbursed $800 for his 10% stake in Apple Computer. In case you're wondering, 10% of Apple Computer would be worth anywhere from $75 to $300 billion. He got $800 for that. So you might be wondering, okay, what led him to take his name off the contract? You can actually watch interviews of Ron Wayne telling you his reasons, but the first one he gives is fear. You see, Ron was the one adult in the room. He was in his 40s. The other 2 guys, the Steves, were in their 20s, and Ron actually had some assets, which meant that if things went sideways and Apple couldn't fulfill their orders and someone came to collect on their debts, they'd be coming after Ron. So he thought he had too much to lose, and he didn't want to risk it. So he played it safe, and he missed out. So Ron Wayne and the unfaithful servant really serve as a cautionary tale for all of us, especially a cautionary tale for cautious people, people like me. I'm actually very careful by nature. I was telling the 9 a.m., I didn't ride roller coasters until I had about 2 years left before I would get sick riding roller coasters. It's like that really small window before you get motion sickness because you're too old. So I really missed my chance on roller coasters. But what this is it's a warning for us. It's a warning for those of us who are in danger of carefully wasting our entire lives in the name of prudence. And what's most concerning maybe about this is no one who's careful thinks they're that guy. No one thinks they're Ron Wayne or the unfaithful servant. No one thinks they're too careful. We have really good reasons for why we're careful. So what I want to do for us to help us all is we want to make sure we're not this guy. We're not carefully wasting our lives. We're not showing up at the end of our life and realizing we've been unfaithful. I want to give us three warning signs that we can all look out for that we see here in this passage so that we might change and not end up like the unfaithful servant. So the first warning sign we see, warning sign number one, is that we've already kind of talked about this. It's that you are stopped by fear. So I'm going to reread verses 24 and 25 when you hear the excuse the unfaithful servant makes. He says, "Master, I know you. You're a difficult man, reaping where you haven't sown and gathering where you haven't scattered seed. So I was afraid and went off and hid your talent in the ground." So the servant's excuse is that he was stopped by fear. And now I want to kind of caveat this as we go through the message here. There are valid reasons not to take certain risks. And it could be a foolish risk with no reason or a bad reason behind it. It might not be the right thing for you to do at that time as you discern what God has for you. But if you look at this particular passage, we get to see the root of his fear. Because listen to what he says. He says, "Master, I know you. You're a difficult man, so I was afraid." So his fears are simply based in his assumptions about his master, which, by the way, the master responds to the faithful servant. You can see his assumptions are actually woefully wrong about his master. So the first warning sign here would tell us, all of us, to pay attention. If you are letting fear stop you from doing things that you're pretty sure, if you got honest, God is calling you to do. And you might have your reasons, but if you did an honest pro and cons list, the only con is, "I am terrified." And you're letting that stop you, then that could be a warning sign that you are carefully wasting your life. The second warning sign we see is that you are led by comfort. So I'm going to read the master's response. He says, "You evil, lazy slave, if you knew that I reap where I haven't sown and gather where I haven't scattered, then you should have deposited my money with the bankers. And when I returned, I would have received my money back with interest." So you see, the master doesn't fully accept the servant's excuse. There may have been fear there, but the master points out, by calling him lazy, that underneath that fear, perhaps, was really this just self-centered desire for comfort. And then beyond that, he calls him evil, showing that waste is not morally neutral. So in his book called The Men We Need, the author Brant Hansen, talks about the commonly held idea that as long as you don't harm anyone, you're a good person. So it's this idea of the harm principle. And he said a lot of people take that idea and kind of just run with it, and we begin to think, okay, as long as I stay kind of locked up in my own little world of entertainment, I'm not harming anybody, so I'm good. And he argues against that in his book. He says, well, actually, when you're doing that, when you lock yourself in your own little comfortable world, you're actually robbing the world of the person you're supposed to be. You're robbing the world of the contributions and the help that you were supposed to bring to the world around you. And then he says this. He says, it's simply not enough for someone to say about their life, "I didn't bother anybody." Interestingly, where older religious traditions attributed to Buddha and Confucius, for example, held the golden rule to be essentially don't do to others what you don't want done to you, Jesus goes well beyond that. In everything, do to others what you would have them do to you. So Jesus calls us, he calls his people, to uncomfortable action. So with this second warning sign, if you can't remember the last time you stepped out of your comfort zone simply for the sake of another person, then it could be a warning sign that you're carefully wasting your life. Now the third warning sign is that you are bored. This one isn't explicitly stated in the passage, but it can be inferred from the story. So we're told that the master, as soon as he left, the unfaithful servant took what he had and he buried it. And then we're told that the master was gone for a long time, which brings the question to mind, what did this guy do the whole time the master was gone? And the story doesn't tell us, but the answer would be, he didn't do anything that mattered. because we're not told the details, and the master labels what he did as good for nothing. So the Christian life, what we're called to as we follow Jesus, it's not a boring life. For example, if you simply start to have your eyes opened to how many opportunities there are around you every day to love your neighbor, then you'll begin to realize that if you're bored, it's only because you are choosing not to act and be involved in all the meaningful, difficult work that's available to you all around, because there's people all around you. So, if you find yourself bored with life, that could be a warning sign for you that you're carefully wasting your life. So after we look at these three warning signs, that you're stopped by fear, you're led by comfort, or you are bored, you might be tempted to kind of snuff out any alarm bells that started going off in your heart or your head as you heard that. Recently, I had an old smoke detector that started going off, and I smashed it with a hammer, which I'm not a psychopath. It wasn't actually like in the house. It was in my toolbox. There's a whole story about it. I still don't know why it went off. It makes sounds like a dying robot as you hit it, like the beeps slowly change, and then it was quiet. But I share that because I think that's human nature. I didn't care why it was going off. I just wanted it to stop. So my encouragement to you is don't smash the alarm. If you feel warning bells going off inside you, don't try to find the quickest way to go back to entertainment or business or projects to smash the alarm bells or the feelings of discomfort as you hear those warning signs going off. Instead, pay attention to the fact that you could be carefully wasting the life that God has given you by being more careful than God wants you to be. So at the very end, when the master gives the servant his suggestion, he said, you should have deposited my money with the bankers. So when we hear that, we might think that's a safe bet. But banking, especially back then, was extremely risky. There was no FDIC-insured banks. There was still a really risky endeavor. So what the master was saying and what Jesus is saying to us is you should have risked. But, of course, most of us, maybe many of us, all the careful ones like me, are probably thinking, yeah, but there's so many bad ideas out there. There is really foolish risk. How do we know the difference between foolish risk and faithful risk? And that's what we'll look at next as we look at the faithful servants and we look at the life of faithful risk. It's our second main idea. I'm going to reread the first few verses of the passage. He says, it is just like a man going on a journey. He called his own slaves and turned over his possessions to them. To one, he gave 5 talents, to another, 2, and to another, 1, to each according to his own ability. Then he went on a journey. Immediately, the man who had received 5 talents went, put them to work, and earned 5 more. In the same way, the man with 2 earned 2 more. So while the unfaithful servant immediately dug a hole and buried what he had, we see the two faithful servants immediately take what they were given and do work that was proportional to their ability and that brought returns. It was fruitful work. Now, we're not told exactly what they did. We're just told that they took risk by investing these large sums of money and then it paid off, that it actually doubled what their master had given them. So if Jesus doesn't give us the exact activities of these guys, how are we supposed to know what it looks like for us to live lives of faithful risk? So to answer that question, I want to do 2 things. First, I want to walk us through some examples of faithful risk and places where you can find more examples, because I can't go through all of them today. And then I want to give us 3 questions that we can ask and we can ask ourselves and our community as we try to discern what does this look like for me specifically. So first, the examples. In the first place, we find examples of faithful risk. No surprise, it's the Bible. The Bible from front to back is filled with examples of people who took risk and did it faithfully. So think of Abraham, who, when he was 75 years old, decided to leave his homeland and follow God, even though he had no idea where he was going. Or think of Ruth, who left her homeland to care for her mother-in-law when there was no guarantee they would even have food. Or think of Esther, who recognized the unique position that she was put in as an Israelite woman who was a queen. And she went before the king without being summoned, which meant she was risking her life in order to plead for her people and see her people redeemed. Or think of Paul, who preached the faith he once tried to destroy and was beaten and stoned and imprisoned and eventually killed for it. So the Bible is full of examples of faithful risk. But that kind of seemed far away, so bring it a little bit closer to home. The next place you can look for examples would be church history. So I'm currently actually pursuing a master's degree very slowly, but I'm in a church history class. And during that class, during this class I'm in right now, I've realized more than anything else I could study, studying church history is studying the history of my people. Which means that if you're a follower of Jesus, church history is the history of your people. More than if I could find the exact written history of the exact tribe I came from in Scandinavia, you know, dating way back, that still wouldn't be the same as studying church history. And when you do that, and you look back over church history, you see that Christians were the ones staying behind in plagued cities to care for the sick. And Christians were the ones taking in unwanted children and welcoming strangers into their home and at their table, even though resources were scarce. And Christians would risk their lives to take the good news of Jesus to the ends of the world. So if you're a follower of Jesus, church history is your history, and it's appropriate to say we have risk in our bones. But if that still seems too far away, because it's church history, the last place you can look is here, our local church, and even the history of this place. So I don't know if you were able to catch it, but we did an interview with our founding pastor, Pastor Jack, that aired at the end of last year. And in that interview, what you can find out is that Pastor Jack and the founding elders of this church, some of the founding elders, they put their homes up as collateral when they were establishing this church and needed a building. They risked their homes for the sake of this church. That's a risk that we are literally still benefiting from today. So, this is kind of a broad overview. You can obviously find examples all over the place. You can search all those places. But what about us specifically? How do we determine if there's a risk that we are specifically called to take or not? So, the next thing I want to do is give us three questions that we can use to really assess what it looks like to live a life of faithful risk. And I'd encourage you, as I go through these, even if you're not a note taker, jot these down, or, you know, this is fine to have your phone out in this part of the sermon. Take a picture of the screen whenever the slide's up there. I would encourage you to write these down and actually meditate on these later throughout the week. So, the first question that we can ask when we're trying to determine, is this a foolish risk or a faithful risk, is simply this: what have you been given? So, just like the servants in this story were investing, everything they were investing, they've been given by the master. The same is true for us. Everything you have, you've been given by God and are called to invest it in his kingdom, in his work. So, this would basically just lead to the question, what do you have? You know, this would be an all-encompassing review of literally everything you have. And this review would include obvious things like your wealth and your skill sets, but it would also include some more non-obvious things. Things such as your childhood. What childhood were you given? What neighborhood do you live in? Or maybe even things like, what challenges have you walked through? What sins have you experienced a little bit of victory over? These are all things, that and so much more, are all things you've been given specifically to invest for the kingdom. And as you take inventory, you might find sometimes it's kind of hard to see what you actually have. So I would encourage you excuse me, to include your community in this and ask other people, what do you see in me? What can you see that I've been given? And I would just give a quick example. I didn't recognize until I was in my 30s how much of a gift my childhood home had been. And the reason I hadn't recognized that is because I hadn't talked to other people about it. And when I started talking to my community and realizing, wow, I have been given this gift of a loving childhood home, and then it gets your wheels turning of, well, why was this given? It's not just for me. How do I use this to invest? So that's the first question. What have you been given? The next question is, what is your capacity? So each servant in this story, we're told they're given different amounts based on their ability. Now, this can sound very similar to the first question, like, well, I was given a certain level of capacity. And that's true. Not, you can't do everything. You have limits. But what's mainly different between these two questions is you actually can't know the answer to this question until you start doing something. You can't know what your capacity is until you've begun to risk and serve and work. So once you start doing that, you'll eventually find out where your limits are. And there's actually a tendency I think we have as Christians to kind of idolize certainty. And what I mean by that is we'll say, I want to know what God's will is for this or for my life. That's a good thing to want to know. It's a good thing to pursue. But a lot of times what we mean when we say that is, I want to know the whole plan so then I can move. But more often than not, the way it works is you might get half a step of the information, and as you're moving, you start to see, oh, this is what God has for me, and you start to see what your capacity actually is. In Romans 12, there's actually a verse that says, by testing, we may know the will of God. And the Greek word there for testing is talking about scrutinizing something to see if it's genuine. And it's a word that would have been used for finding out if a ship was seaworthy. So what this means is that to understand what your capacity is, you're going to have to get out in the open water. You're going to have to start risking. You're going to have to really find out what it means to take those steps. And as you do that, first off, you'll find out what your limits are. But secondly, you might be amazed as you do for one person what you wish you could do for everyone. And as you start small and you're faithful in small things, you might be amazed by what God can do with your limited capacity. So the first two questions are, what have you been given and what is your capacity? And before we get to the third question, I just want to point out that not everyone is given the same things. You know, even in the story, some had more talents, some had greater ability. And I think that's really important to point out because that can help us really war against the game of comparison that we are so prone to in our world. So if you look at that story, you won't try to force other people to be exactly like you. And you won't desperately wish you were just like everybody else. The master wasn't looking for who had the most talents when he got back. He was looking at for who had been faithful with what they'd been given. Just think about it. If the guy with five had buried his, he would have had the most at the end. But he would not have been faithful. So this protects us from things like envy, where if you start doing this assessment and you start like to feel like you're not enough compared to other people, this idea can war against that. Hey, it's not about who has the most, it's who's faithful. And it can protect you from complacency or even pride if you think that, well, I'm good because I'm doing more than them. Maybe you were given five talents. Maybe there's more expected of you. So it can help us war against both envy and pride and complacency because we've all been given different amounts and we've just been asked to be faithful with what it is we actually have. So now I'll get to the third question. But one of my concerns as I put together this teaching is that it would be received as like a spiritualization of ambition. Like as long as you're ambitious and risky, you're pleasing God. That's not actually what I'm saying. There is such a thing as selfish ambition. There is such a thing as foolish risk. So this last question will really, really help drill down on the difference. And it's this: what are you risking for? So if you hear this message and, for example, you think, all right, I'm starting my company, I'm taking the risk, that could be a great idea. That could also be a terrible idea. And the way you know the difference is by getting really, really honest about what you're risking for. What are you taking that risk for? Because are you doing it for your own glory, and your own wealth, and your own gain, your own reputation, your own dreams? Or are you doing it for the reason the faithful servants risked in this parable? Which if you read the parable, you see that the faithful servants invested the master's money for the master's joy. And if you're wondering, okay, well, what does that mean? What's the master's joy? How does that help me? I want to read you something out of Hebrews chapter 12. This is verse 1 and 2. So the very beginning of Hebrews chapter 12, the author has just finished going through in Hebrews chapter 11 what has been called the Hall of Faith. So he's giving example after example of faithful risk. And then this is what he says at the beginning of chapter 12. He says, therefore, since we also have such a large cloud of witnesses surrounding us, let us lay aside every weight and the sin that so easily ensnares us. Let us run with endurance the race that lies before us, keeping our eyes on Jesus, the source and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that lay before him endured a cross and despised the shame and has sat down at the right hand of God's throne. So what we see here is that it says, for the joy that was set before Jesus, he endured the cross. And Pastor Ryan has talked about this, but what was the joy set before Jesus? What did he not have before the cross that he could have after the cross? And the answer is us. Jesus gave up everything. He didn't risk. He knew what he was giving up. And he gave up everything on the cross for you. And what that paints a picture for is that he used all he had for the sake of others and for the glory of God. And what that means for us when you're assessing this, what are you risking for? All faithful risk is for the sake of others and for the glory of God. And if that is your why behind the risk you're considering, then you have a risk worth seriously considering. Now, this isn't just a teaching for individuals. It is for that, for you to individually reflect on these questions and think, what is God calling me to? This is also a teaching for our church, for us, right now. Because I can't help but look around at our church and just be blown away by how resource-rich we are as a church. So, for example, because of the faithfulness and responsibility of past generations and because of your current generosity, we are in a really good financial situation as a church. Beyond that, when I look around at the people here, at the staff and the elders and the volunteers and the deacons and the deaconesses, I'm blown away by the level of high-capacity people that God has brought to this little church in Severn. And beyond that, we have a why worth risking for. We exist to see lives transformed by Jesus. And by the grace of God, we've actually been seeing that. We see new folks connecting in ways they never have before. We see people who've been here for years growing in ways they never have before. And we see people putting their faith in Jesus for the first time and being baptized. There are so many churches who would die to have something like that. And we've been handed all these things. And it's not just for us. It's not just for us. So, seeing all that we've been entrusted with as a local church, we need to deeply and seriously consider, what are our responsibilities? How are we faithful with what we've been given? And this is something the elders have been talking about a lot lately. And while we don't have the specifics, we know that we've been given much, so much is expected. And we do not want to bury what we've been given. We want to invest it for the sake of others and for the glory of God. So I'm going to call up the worship team, and we're going to end here today. So if you read through the Bible, you get a pretty clear picture that God is for the underdog. David and Goliath is kind of the perfect example. We still use that to talk about underdogs in our culture today. But what's interesting about this parable is that the guy who gets one talent, the underdog, he's actually the bad guy. So what's that about? Why is the guy who gets five talents held up as like the model for what we should do? And I think the reason for that is that he actually had the most to lose. So if you remember what the unfaithful servant said, his excuse, he said, "I know you." He said, "Master, I know you." He said, "You are a difficult man, so I was afraid." Now, if that were true, the servant given five talents should have been most afraid, because he was given the most. He had the most to lose. But he wasn't the most afraid. He didn't just bury it. Instead, he was willing to use all he had, even though he had the most to lose. Now, who does that sound like? It sounds like Jesus, who had everything. And again, he didn't risk it. He gave it, knowing full well what it would cost him. And he did that for our sake, so that now, when we see Jesus, when we see the Master giving everything for us, then we can say, "Master, I know you, and that is why I am not afraid." We can say, "Master, I know that you've given me not only everything I have, but everything I need, because you gave me yourself. And you hold all things in your hands. And you've already achieved victory. And you've said that the gates of hell won't stand against your church. So I know you. And that is why I can risk all that I have for your sake and for the sake of others." Now today we're going to end with communion, which is a great physical reminder of all that Jesus gave to us. And during this last song, you can come up, you can grab the bread, you can grab the juice and take it back to your seat. But don't take it yet. We'll take it all together at the end. But while you're sitting there with the bread and the juice, I would encourage you, first off, to recognize what that represents, all that you were given. Even if you're not financially wealthy or feel like you have all the brains in the world, you have the body and the blood of Christ given for you. So recognize what you've been given. But then I would encourage you to begin the conversation with God. What are you asking me to do? What does faithful risk look like for me? And after everyone has the bread and the juice, I'll come up here and lead us in communion. But as we take communion, remember that that represents that Jesus was cast into outer darkness so that you don't ever have to be. So before we take communion, I want to read for us again those verses out of Hebrews 12. This is Hebrews 12, verses 1 and 2. Therefore, since we also have such a large cloud of witnesses surrounding us, let us lay aside every weight and the sin that so easily ensnares us. Let us run with endurance the race that lies before us, keeping our eyes on Jesus, the source and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that lay before him endured a cross and despised the shame and has sat down at the right hand of God's throne. Let's take communion. Let me pray for us. Father, thank you for your love for us. Thank you for the fact that you don't only model what it looks like to sacrifice, but you give us all that we need in order to be able to do that for others, that we are overflowing with your grace and your love. If only we would know that, and I just pray that that is what you would do in us today. You would also help us to grasp your love and your grace and who you really are in a way we haven't before, so that we would become a kind of people who could truly risk all that we have, give all that we have, knowing that we're actually totally secure and safe in you. Help us to be a people who love you and who love others with the way we go about our lives. We pray this in your name, Jesus. Amen. Well, thank you, church. Hope you have a great rest of your weekend, and we hope to see you soon.